Breaking the stigma of addiction.
This is Zach's Life, a story of love, addiction, loss, grief, and recovery.
Reflecting on Zachary Horton
and others in our community,
both inside and outside of their addiction. Hosted by Jim Horton
of the Zachary Horton Foundation.
Good morning, everyone. I'm happy to have Angelica Carlino with me today. Good morning, Angelica. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm fine. I'm good.
Thanks so much for joining us today. This is going to be a very interesting episode. I met Angelica a couple weeks ago. She came and spoke at a Kiwanis meeting that I attend regularly, and she just had a fascinating story about her dad, who was a vet. And anyway, I'm gonna let her share that today. And just so you know, a lot of times when we do a podcast, so this is already our second and third attempt to start this, because I could not pronounce her name correctly. And she has a very fast. And what did you say? So her name is Angelica Carlino. Her dad's name was
Gilbert Pino.
Pino.
That would make me Angelica Pino Carlino.
Which I say is like the perfect Sopranos actress, right? To throw in there. So anyway, we were having some fun with that. And Angelica, tell us a little bit about your history. Tell us about what you do, first of all, right now. I know you're an RN, so just give us just a little background about you right now.
Right. So I'm a registered nurse. I've been a nurse since 2010. I would call myself a latecomer to a career. Prior to that, I was a stay-at-home mom. I have 7 kids, so I consider myself a professional wrangler. I work in skilled nursing with behavioral. So I work with a lot of schizophrenics, bipolar. Most of my patients are conserved. So I come through the mental health care through that system, which isn't a traditional setting in the SNF, but is fast becoming a setting for the mentally ill.
Now here's a question I didn't ask before. Do you find, because I know in the substance use disorder field, mm-hmm. mental health issues are almost always co-occurring. There's something, my son struggled with depression, but I see that a lot. Do you also find that in some of the older patients that you have too, that have mental health issues? Are they often combined with some kind of a substance use disorder?
They are, especially the patients that we see now. We traditionally think of a SNF setting as, our grandmas and our grandpas when they fall and break their hip, or they have advanced dementias where, you're no longer able to take care of them at home. Traditionally, the SNF would be the setting where you would place them. But the population is shifting now, where we are seeing more of age range of 50 to 60, people that are mentally ill, as well as substance abusers, whether that's alcohol, methamphetamine. We see a lot of methamphetamine abuse, and they're mentally ill. And also, I would say thirdly tied to that is the physical effects that you see, like with some of our patients that have long-term methamphetamine abuse, those dementias become permanent, and so there is no moving away from it, as well as the effects of the abuse of alcohol, with leading into problems with their liver, cirrhosis, ascites, all the things that go with long-term alcohol abuse combined with mental illness, and then the physical ailments that those things also cause. So that is now what we see in the SNF. So it is an evolving subsector of our healthcare system.
So, and I find that interesting in that, my podcast is based around the experiences, that I had with my son, and a lot of our guests are younger recovering people, and we seldom think about what addiction looks like in our senior population. And maybe for some reason, you know, and I don't know that that's it. We'll get into your story here in just a minute, but you know, people that have survived 50 years as an alcoholic or as a drug abuser, you know, they're survivors. You know, they found a way to navigate the system. And so, you know, now, and probably in families, we cut them a lot of slack. Hey, that's just Uncle Joe, you know. You know, you realize he's always like that at Christmas and Thanksgiving. And so you just keep the little kids away after 2 o'clock or, you know, when football hits halftime, it's time to leave and go home. And, you know, we just cover for them. I mean, do you find that to kind of be the case?
Yes, there are. And actually, alcohol is probably the most destructive drug because it takes time in the body. But what you see when someone is 50 or 60, which is generally if they've lived their life as high consumption alcoholic, it's around the 50s where you'll start to see they have really liver problems. When you have liver problems, the symptoms are not pleasant. You get ascites, which is fluid buildup. It's destructive on your kidneys. You'll see patients who are on renal failure, which can lead to end-stage renal disease and dialysis. And you often wonder, you know, sometimes I see my patients and I think to myself, if they could have a glimpse of what their life is like now when they're 25 or 30 partying, would it make a difference? You know, was it all worth it because of the destruction? I know in addiction, a lot of times we think of that, the quick destruction, right? Someone has an overdose and they die.
Right.
But there's a slow destruction that is evolving not only in their head mentally, in that the depression and all of that, you know, feeling sorry for yourself, but the body can only tolerate so much and it will let you know when it's tolerated enough. And it's not pleasant.
Hmm. Well, so these will be some things I know that we'll touch on a little later too. So, and I have to say, what a surprise it, again, your presentation was to our group. We do a lot of, we get a lot of support that we do is with the veteran, different veterans groups. And we have a lot of speakers that come in about veterans, and that's certainly how your story started out. So tell us a little bit about your dad, about his, you know, we certainly want to celebrate
right.
that part of his life.
So my dad was in the Army. He was career Army. And I think he joined the Army in 1956. So he didn't serve directly in Korea, but he did serve along the DMZ and the aftermath of that. He also was in Vietnam. He was, I call my dad a soldier. He was the kind of soldier. He was, he talked the talk and he walked the walk. He was a platoon sergeant. He was a drill sergeant at Fort Ord. He was the kind of soldier that you see when you watch a movie like We Were Soldiers, and you have the Sam Neill character in that movie. He just was a leader. When he served in Vietnam, he served two tours of duty in Vietnam, and I was born in between, so I call myself a sandwich baby, born between his two tours of duty. He earned 3 Bronze Stars. He earned a Purple Heart. He won a Gallantry Star from the Vietnamese government. And one of his Bronze Stars that he won was crawling. He was shot crawling on his stomach to save 2 other soldiers. So, to say the least, he was a soldier. Now, given that, like I said, I was born in between on Fort Ord in 1968. And to go back a little bit, Fort Ord, you know, really was a clearinghouse for Vietnam. Most people that went to Vietnam went through Fort Ord, right?
Okay.
They did basic training. Fort Ord was one of the largest installations of the Army bases. So it has a rich history. My dad spent most of his time on Fort Ord, other than the time he spent in Germany, where he met and married my mom in Germany. My mom is German. My mom is actually a Holocaust survivor. So I like to say I was born with a cloud over my, head. If your dad served multiple combat duties in Vietnam and your mom is a Holocaust survivor, you're already born deep thinking. So when my dad retired, they bought a home in Marina, which is next to Monterey. And right. That's where I grew up. The base was the center of life. The base was, at that time, the middle class of Monterey, right? Monterey got a lot of money, and then you had Fort Ord, and then there's a lot of poverty, too. So,
well, and it's still the place that everyone in Fresno likes to go to in the summertime when it's
right
and deathly hot here. We love, especially as a golfer, we love to go to the Monterey area. It's just beautiful.
It is spectacular. And I often say that my geography actually saved me, because I think had I'd have grown up in my household in like Kansas on a military base, I wouldn't have made it, because when things would get tough for me, I could go to the ocean and see the power. Wow. And it was just, it was empowering. Like,
yes.
Like the world was your oyster. So I think that was fortuitous too. So
now let me ask, so you mentioned that your dad was a soldier and he was a drill sergeant. Mm-hmm. Does that translate to life at home too? Did you march out of your room in the morning and make your bed to flip a quarter off of? And
We did. In fact, I love, one of my favorite talks I use when I'm training nurses is there's a commander in the Navy who gives the talk about, if you want to be successful, get up every day and make your bed.
Right.
I love that talk. But yeah, you make your bed, you get up, and you accomplish that first task of the day. Things were very disciplined, and then they weren't. So my dad, when he got out of the military, right away, he transition time is often really hard for veterans. They're not really sure what they're going to do, especially someone who's career military.
How old was your dad when he got out of?
He was 38.
Oh, 38. Not old.
He joined the military when he was 17. His grandparents signed for him to go back then. You could do that. So when he got out... And he wanted to stay in the military longer, but he wanted to do something on a desk. But he was always being told, we need you in the field. We need your expertise. We need you training troops. And so he just, his body couldn't do it anymore. So he retired. Then he transitioned after he retired. A friend of his hooked him up with a company called Vinel, which was... military training in Saudi Arabia. So they hire retired military, and this is like late 70s. So they were training the Saudi National Guard. And while he was in Saudi Arabia, he completed one 18-month stint and signed up to do another one. When he went back the second time, and he'd only been there for a few weeks, he was hit, him and his coworker, while walking down the street in Riyadh by a truck and left for dead. So it was a hit and run. We never really found out what happened, because they had to medevac him out. My mom had to get involvement with like the State Department to get him out. And he was really badly injured. He broke everything from the pelvis down.
Oh, my goodness.
And they medevaced him to Greece. While he was there, he suffered a massive heart attack. He spent... I want to say a couple of weeks in Greece, and then they medevaced him back home to Monterey. When he got home, he was permanently disabled. And so he already was having the trauma of this accident, the trauma of his, you know, Vietnam combat duties. He started drinking as his coping mechanism, as I think a lot of vets did. You know, my dad would hang out at the VFW, which is the Veterans of Foreign War, and sit and drink with his fellow veterans. And it really led him down a chaotic path. Growing up, there would be times where he would have flashbacks as well. My mom would have to call the police. They would 5150 him, and then he'd be back like the next day. And then it was like a cycle. So it would... his flashbacks would cycle, you know, every few months. Then he was drinking on top of that. Although the weird thing is my dad never drank in the house. So I never saw liquor in our house ever. No beer, nothing. He would drink either at the VFW or at, there was a local bar in Marina that he liked to drink at. And then he would come home drunk. And then my parents would argue and fight. And it was just a cycle. And, you know.
So Angelica, let me ask, because, and we talked about this earlier, that Monterey is a very small community that's there. But yet there were a lot of service people because of Fort Ord. So it was a military community as well. Right. Was your dad highly thought of in the community because of his service at that time? Or was he one of thousands that are around all the time?
He was one of thousands. Marina is actually, most of the people in Marina are retired military. So there's... Everyone's dad I grew up with was retired something.
Okay.
You know, and
so you had a community within the community.
Right. It was mostly retirees, you know, and it wasn't unusual, right? That your dad had some issues. Lots of people's dads had some issues, right? And you knew that that's, nobody really talks about it. It's just your dad was, you know, oh, you know, this happened. And then he would go. And most of our medical care came from, there was a hospital on Fort Ord, a big hospital. And I don't really ever remember like my dad ever or anyone reaching out with any kind of services for PTSD. You just, that wasn't a phrase then. It was definitely, PTSD was not a phrase. But you knew it was there, right?
Right.
You just had a crazy dad, kind of. And mostly all my friends I grew up with, they all had retired military parent. And so it wasn't like something, I guess, unusual, because it just is
right
what it was. People would come and go, you know, and especially at that time, Vietnam was coming to an end. Everyone's dad had some involvement with Vietnam. So
he wasn't special.
He wasn't special. No. You know, most of my friends, their parents also had service medals and things like that. You just didn't think of it like that.
Right,
it just was the community you lived in. So it was really a little strange because like you said about the making the bed, there was discipline. We had discipline in our house. And then there was chaos. When my dad wasn't drinking, he was very disciplined. When he was drinking, it was very chaos. So you could spin from one extreme to the other really, really fast. And so needless to say, it was challenging growing up. And I had a sister and I had two older brothers. And I'm the youngest by 6 years. So they moved out as soon as they could, which left me there with my dad. And this was especially after the accident and things were kind of crazy.
Is your thought that they moved out because they wanted to get away from the chaos?
They wanted to get away from the chaos.
Okay.
It was a lot of chaos. I mean, there would be, we had a Christmas once when my dad came home drunk and he knocked the Christmas tree over. Those are the kind of memories we had growing up. So it was not pleasant. And my mom was super codependent. Now I can say that now because I know what codependent is, but then right. You don't know. But she was enabling, and I honestly felt bad for my mom, because here's my mom. She survived Nazi Germany, thinking she hit the jackpot, marrying an American GI, and it was just as much chaos. You know what I mean? And she just didn't really know how to deal with it. When I was little, she didn't speak much English. You know, she came here and was kind of self-taught. You teach yourself to speak the language. So she didn't have a lot of resources. And I don't remember there being a lot of resources for, like, you know, military spouses or things like that. Nobody talked about PTSD. Nobody talked about, hey, how's this going to impact your family? You know what I mean? It's just kind of like people went to war. They came back. And they were like bombs dropping in your home, you know what I mean, that are explosive. And you just make up how you're going to survive, right? It's like a day-to-day thing. And so you pick up a lot of maladaptive behaviors that come along with that. And nobody really was reaching out then. Things are better now. There's way more support now. There's way more awareness of soldiers. But honestly, drinking was a way that a lot of soldiers coped. And that honestly is probably why there are places like the Veterans of Foreign War, so they could go talk about their stuff and and drink. And that, you know, led to a spiral where it got out of control for my dad, you know, ultimately culminating in his drunk driving accident in 2000. So, you know, a little bit about that. So by the time I left home and moved out here to Fresno, my mom had gotten a divorce. Their divorce became final on my birthday. The day I turned 21, their divorce became final after being married for 29 years. And the really sad thing is I really think my parents loved each other, but they were both so dysfunctional. You know what I mean? They were both so dysfunctional. And my mom couldn't take it anymore, and she needed to ground herself. And that led my dad to more drinking. And the accident he had, where he, after drinking at the VFW all morning, I think the article in the newspaper said he had drank 5 beers at the VFW. He had dropped my nephew, who was 15, at Monterey High School for football practice and was on his way to the post office, which was his habit. My dad was a creature of habit. And on the way, he ran up on the curve and hit a family of 5 that was walking, killing their 2 children, an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old.
Oh, my.
And it was horrible. It was a horrible, horrible, horrible accident. And that kind of changed everything. You know, he was arrested. He ultimately pled guilty and was sentenced to 20 years in prison, and with the stipulation that he serve 85%. And he died in prison in 2009. And, you know, for me, I was living out here, and I was pregnant with my son. I had 5 daughters in a row, and I was super excited that we were having a boy.
Sure.
And that phone call from my mom just sucked me right back into the moment, right back into the household, and it was devastating. And I don't even feel that I could talk about it, because there's that shock. Wow, this is my dad. And now he's killed 2 children.
Right.
You know
what
I mean? And you can't even say it. You can't even say it. And because there's so much shame there, you know? And
And especially from, I know when you shared the story for our group a few weeks ago, we had been just admiring all the medals that you had talked about. And a lot of the guys in our group are, you know, have had military experience and were around that. And so we were just celebrating this incredible life and the heroic actions that he had undertook for, you know, for over 2 decades of his service. And then to have it culminate then when you shared that story, and that's what happens I think in the world of addiction where I live, is that that's the only thing that he's remembered for now,
right?
And I'm sure, and at that moment I'm sure that that's how you felt, and I'm sure that that had I mean, for you and your siblings, I'm sure it had a profound effect. I mean, not just the trauma that you had lived with growing up in that environment. You didn't know that that was trauma,
no.
As you said. It was normal for everybody.
Right.
You know, but now all of a sudden you're just brought right back to that. And I'm sure it had an effect for you and for your siblings. So, I mean, how did that play out for you then?
It it did, because, you know, you see yourself, and even though I grew up in that house, I mean, like it was normal. That was the way we grew up. That was, you can only compare to what you know. So that was normal. And you think in one moment that my dad is, you know, he's a war hero, you know, he's done all these things. And in one moment, that perception just shifted. And it's like, we almost had to forget all that because it was too real. And we didn't want the perception that there is no justification for the accident. There is no justification, right? You can't even say that. And it took me years. And honestly, I felt that I just needed, for me, I needed to separate away from it, because my psyche was pretty shaky, right? I was trying to rebuild after the turbulence of my childhood to build a more healthy life. So I could not allow myself to be drawn back into it. But at the same time, I could not really talk about my dad because I didn't want to take away from the fact that two children were killed.
Right.
You know, that they'll never have a life. So I felt like I could not even talk about anything because nothing would take away from that.
So you're feeling guilty
for everything.
For something that you didn't, right. And that's a guilt that you're
right. And so
living with.
Oh. I just couldn't. And my sister, she was a lot like my dad, and she also struggled with drinking. And so the irony is that a couple years prior to the accident, my dad had planned an intervention for my sister after Thanksgiving in 1999, where we all got together and confronted her with her drinking, and she got sober. And the day of my dad's sentencing, she was at the courthouse and they had interviewed her, and she had said that she had been lucky, because had it been 3 years prior, it could have been her to have that accident, and that she had been scared straight, and she had her 2-year chip with her, you know, at that sentencing. And the reporter in the article that was written, he had said that if there's any silver lining in this story, it's that my sister had obtained sobriety. But after my dad died in 2009, in prison, he actually died in the same infirmary as Charles Manson. And I don't know why I think about that, but I'm like, wow, look, you know, he lived his life and there he dies, you know, in the same place that Charles Manson did. And that's really tough. Well, my sister died of a drug overdose 6 months following that. And it's like, even that was tough, you know. My sister was struggling a little bit. I had graduated nursing school shortly after my dad died. He never even got to see me be a nurse. I'm kind of bummed about that. I think he would have liked.
Sure.
But right after I graduated, I got a job, and I called my sister on my way home from the interview, and I said, hey, I got a job. And she said, she was so excited. She said, oh, I can't wait. I can come to Fresno. I can help you with the kids. I can move in together. And I said, oh, that would be great. You know, and then 2 weeks later, she died. And that was the last conversation I had with her. And so, you know.
Angelica, I'm just struck by the perpetual trauma for your life, and not just your life, but for many others, but specifically it's your story we're talking about today, and just the perpetual trauma that's been brought on by, and again, for your dad, it was just alcohol abuse. You know, your dad wasn't a heroin addict.
Nope.
Right?
Nope.
Right? Wasn't a meth addict.
Nope.
You know, that wasn't it. And sometimes I know that we think of, especially in the fentanyl age and in the opiate crisis that we have, you know, we forget that more people die of alcoholism every year, and the effects of that are so far more far reaching than anything that happens with all the other drugs combined.
Right.
And we forget about that. But because it's so long lasting too, I think the overwhelming sadness of your story is just the tentacles of how it's reached into your life and how it reached into your sister's life. And I'm sure with all of your children, there's not a positive memory of grandpa, right? That they get to hold,
no.
That they can talk about it, show and tell, or that they can pass on to their children. Right. So now all of a sudden there's this finality in your history that has come. And again, that's the thing that's just so horrendous, you know, for me that I see. And people who have families that suffer with other diseases, that's a trauma that they don't have to live with, but it's still a trauma that I live with in my family because of how I lost my son, and then how you'll live with in your family. And then you have the added burden and weight of again the terrible accident,
right,
that took place, and not even and you can't even really grieve your father's loss and his passing, because if there's any other friends that you grew up with or whatever, it's like, you know, I mean, and you were telling me earlier, you know, how, you know, when you're, you know, when you do go home, you know, there's always this cloud that's still,
it's always a cloud. It's all, in fact, we were just, I just went back to the coast 2 weeks ago. And that was the first time that, I drove my husband by the accident scene. That's the first time that I've driven by the accident scene where, wow, where it happened. And I don't know why, just on the way home, I said, hey, let's go this way. Let me show you. And, it was a little surreal. You know what I mean? That, like, this is where it happened, right here.
Right.
Front of church's chicken. You know what I mean? This is where the worst day ever happened. And, yeah, it's always tough because I don't want to run into people. I'm better now. I can run into people because I'm stronger now. But before, I just had no words.
Right.
What am I going to say? What am I going to say?
Right. So let's shift a little bit and talk about what have you done to bring, because I'll tell you, you are one of the most bubbly, shining people. If I ever have to be treated and cared for, you are the one that I want. I mean, you are just full of joy. And again, knowing your story now and your backstory, I mean, wow, to get from where you are to here, there's obviously been a lot of healing, right? That's
right,
that's taking place for you. So let's talk about that just for a few minutes, about how did you get to where you're at today? What has that process been like?
So I struggled myself, especially during the time when I was becoming a nurse. I had, you know, a lot going on in my life, you know, going through a divorce and then having my sister, my dad, and then my brother would die all in the same window. It was a lot. And I honestly was in survival mode, where I was just trying to keep my focus on nursing school because I had to achieve that, right? I needed to make some money and to be able to provide for my kids. And that kind of kept me grounded. I did struggle with my own battles of excess. And then one day I'm remarried. My husband is also named Jim. I met him.
Sounds like a great guy already.
I met him in 2015. And shortly after we met, we had gone out one evening, and it happened to be on the anniversary of when my brother passed away. My brother passed away a year after my sister died of bone cancer, which he never sought treatment for. So, I mean, he had a lot of self-esteem issues, and I'm pretty sure that's all related to to how he grew up. But I just had a meltdown one night. I mean, like a volcano meltdown of holding in all those emotions for so long, because I knew when I was in nursing school, if I let myself have a chance to think about everything,
right,
it was going to implode on me and I was not going to be able to function. So I was a master stuffer. I could just stuff it down and get rid of it for a while. And then that one particular evening, it just all came out and I had a huge meltdown. And it was at that point I said, if I don't change the way I'm thinking about things, I'm going to die. I'm going to end up like my sister or my dad or my brother, and I'm going to die, you know, from a combination of drinking too much and thinking the wrong thoughts, going down with dark thoughts. And it was from that point I started to allow myself to feel the pain that was always there,
right,
but I was covering. And it was like a light bulb went off and I started moving myself through my emotions and doing a lot of writing, a lot of thinking, and really coming to the realization that I'm in control of my destiny, not my history of events. That if I think positive thoughts, all my actions can be positive, right? And I kind of took it back to nursing actually and medicine, thinking all actions start as thought potentials, right? If I want to pick up the bottle of water, I have to tell my arm to pick up the water and drink it. If I'm thinking negative thoughts, my actions will be negative. My actions will be self-destructive. I will go down a rabbit hole that will only get darker and darker and darker. So I tried to force myself to think positive thoughts. And then my life started to become more positive. So when negative things would happen, I choose to see the lesson in it and use that as a force forward. And once I started to, and that was in everything, like even the music I listened to or the things I watched on television. You know, I found myself when I was going through a lot and I felt devastated, I would tend to watch darker things on television.
Right.
And listen to darker music. And I had to stop. I had to create an environment that was positive. So I just stopped surrounding myself with dark thoughts, however that would be. Music, friends, you know, my environment in my house. I try to keep it light. I try to wake up every day and have a positive thought. And as I became into my career and nursing, I got to see when I would have feedback with patients, if I give love, I get love. If I approach my patients with optimism and enthusiasm, they respond better. And that just kind of became the way I started to approach everything. And then things got easier because my thoughts got lighter. So it is what I call purposeful joy. You have to purposely find joy. So I'm definitely a silver lining dreamer. I can find, you know, the silver lining in any bad situation, right?
Even you're a cup half full.
Yeah, kind of gal. I'm always a cup half full because the cup half empty only leads to another negative thought and then another negative thought. And if all your thoughts are negative, your life will be negative because all actions start as thoughts. So that kind of was the shifting. So I think that nursing definitely has saved me. It was a career that I not really originally, I didn't grow up thinking I want to be a nurse. I actually wanted to be a lawyer. But I think nursing came to me because I needed it, right? I needed to nurse myself, and now I nurse patients. So I'm a very minimalist as a nurse. I believe less is more. You know, I believe in the art of nursing. Nursing is a science and an art, right? There's the science. We can put an IV in. We can put a Foley catheter in. We can do all these wonderful things. But then there's the art of nursing, which is holding someone's hand, touching, the power of touch, the power of encouragement. That's my sweet spot in nursing. You know what I mean? And when you do that, outcomes are better. Actually, yeah. Healthier patients or happier patients or healthier patients, right? So I think that nursing kind of saved me because it gave me a purpose and it gave me a way to express empathy and really understand. So when I first came to the building that I was at, which was all people who I would say would be like profoundly mentally ill, you know, the people we would think, you know, the schizophrenics, that it's really, they can't function, right? Because it's got such a grip on them. When I first went in that building, I was scared because the patients were edgy and it was that really kind of, everyone's giving you the side eye and you never really knew if they could snap. To after working there, you know, for a few months, which turns into a few years, it was fun. It was fun. These were patients who just needed love. They needed joy. They needed vibrance. They needed to feel like somebody loved them just the way they are. And then the building became a different place. And that made me so excited to see when we would have surveyors come from the state and they'd be like, wow, I can't believe this is the same building. I'm like, hey, little joy, little happiness goes a long way. And they would ask me, what are you doing? And I said, you know, I mean, I'm a good nurse. I know how to carry out policy, this
sure,
and that.
Sure.
I said, but the biggest thing we bring the joy. And when you bring the joy, people feed off joy.
Well, and I think, Angelica, I think that's a message that obviously works in the facility that you go to every right. day. But I think that's also a message that works in families.
Right.
It's a message that works in recovery centers and that works for anyone that's experienced a trauma is that if we can have more of that, then I think that's definitely going to bring more positive outcomes.
Right.
And now given, and as we wrap up today, I want to focus just for a couple minutes on, given the history that you've seen with vets, in your family specifically, and the issues with alcohol abuse that's taking place there. If there's other families out there that see themselves in any part of your story, you know, what would you encourage them to do? Because you've come out the other side. Now, it wasn't that way for your sister, right? But it was that way for you. So you obviously did some things that were, you know, that were different. And I know we all, especially in grief situations, we all walk our own path, right? I get that. So, I mean, you haven't wrote a book that has 5 easy steps to healing and trauma or anything like that. But what kind of, the way that you can in talking about positivity, what kind of message would you want families to have out there that might have experienced even a portion of what you've went through?
I think what's important is and the veterans have way more support than my dad's generation did, right? Because he was not, World War II, they had a lot of support, right? They had, people thought that was the best thing ever, support. But the Vietnam vets, they got a shady deal because, you know, people weren't supportive of their efforts and whatnot. But I think probably one of the most important things I think is that when soldiers come home, they have experienced a lot, right? And that we support the soldier, but we need to support the family, right? We need to support the spouse and the children, because that's set up in the home. You know, when I used to go to church, we used to have a saying that more is caught than taught. Like the things your children see, the patterns of your life, those will influence them more than any things that you're going to sit down and tell them, right? They're going to see you and see how you live your life and see the patterns that you follow, and they will mimic, right? That's how children learn, by mimicking. And if we don't change the course and recognize that PTSD isn't just affecting the family or just the soldier, but the family, it will just perpetuate into other things, right? So if what I try to do, and I've worked with a lot of veterans because obviously they come into skilled nursing all the time, is understanding and to find the connection with them, right? I find when I have my veterans family, when you know, they're talking about something and I'm like, hey, I know. I grew up in that house. I know, crazy. You know what I mean? To try to break the ice and to connect with people. Right, I think right. One of the biggest things that we've lost is connection, right? Connection is the opposite of addiction.
Right.
Connection is the opposite of addiction. Even though we have technology that is supposed to connect us, it's not. It's not. We're losing the human touch. We need the human touch. People need to feel like they matter and that they're loved. And you can't do that without the human touch. You have to find the commonality and connect. And we have to offer ourselves up like life preservers, right? When I was living through all my chaos, I needed a life preserver thrown to me to help me so I didn't drown in the sea of chaos. We need to be life preservers to help someone who's drowning. And the littlest things matter. Little things matter. So be kind. Use human touch. Don't be afraid to hold somebody's hand. Those are the things that we're missing, because technology has taken us in such an impersonal way. People just need to connect. They need to touch somebody's heart. And when you, the term prick somebody's heart, they feel that. And then that's the nurturing that will build the closeness that they need to be reeled back in. So I think if you have the opportunity, try to be kind. You know, if you see someone struggling, offer a hand and just be there and recognize someone where they are in the place that they are and see their value. Sometimes you just have to see somebody's value, you know, to connect. One time when I was in nursing school, I was driving and I got off the McKinley. I was at City College. Mm-hmm. And I got off the McKinley exit to go to City College. And there was this homeless lady that used to push her grocery cart right there. And I was coming around and I was like, I don't know why, something said, hey, stop and go give her something. Right. So I missed her and I had to go around the block and come back around in my car. And I stopped the car and she was right there. And I didn't even have anything. I was like, what? I had a Diet Pepsi with me that I had and was going to take it to school. And I was like, excuse me. I got out of the car. I'm like, excuse me. And she was pushing her cart. And I said, oh, I saw you and I just wanted to give this to you, right? And I said, what is your name? And she started to cry. And she said, you know, I can't think of the last time somebody asked me what my name was. And I thought, oh my God, like, that is how disconnected we've become, that we don't see people for who they are. And I think people just need people to know who they are.
Wow. Angelica, today you've touched our hearts.
Thank you.
Thank you for Thank you for sharing your story. Your healing, your insights to healing. And I know someone out there will hear this and it'll have great meaning for them. It did for me.
Thank you.
So, and as always, I'm going to encourage you to reach out today to just someone that you know and tell them that you love them. I'm Zach's dad.
This has been an episode of Zach's Life. Thank you so much for listening. For more info on our foundation and for addiction resources, visit ZacharyHortonFoundation.org or check us out on Facebook and Instagram. If you have a story to tell and want to be a guest on our podcast, email me directly at jim@ZacharyHortonFoundation.org.